Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
That lovely introduction. I'm going to do I plan to do. Always a mistake to say what one's going to do. Say what you intend to do. What I intend to do is to read only a few poems from over a number of years, and then devote the rest of the time to reading from the new long poem that I'm selfishly happy arrived in time this evening, although it's not supposed to be published until the middle of next month. So I will just read, I think, 5 or 6 poems, starting with one that was written back in the 60s and coming up to one that was written very recently, and then tell you something about the long poem. The first one was one that I was asked to read. And when I find it, I can never find anything. Once things are published in a book, they're lost. It's a poem called The Owl. And it's disappeared. Here it is. And it, you know, the thing is that I'm going to read something from The Vixen. This poem was written long before The Vixen, but it was written in and of the same place that The Vixen poems were. An old woman whom I knew long ago in that part of the world told me that she had been deported. Few women were deported during World War II, but she had been deported to Germany for forced labor during World War II. And when the war was over, as soon as the Allies broke through that part of Germany, she got on the road and started walking, and she walked all the way back. And I said, "What was it that made you? What was it was drawing you?" And she said, "Oh, c'était le pays rêvé." She said, "It was the land that I dreamed about." She didn't have to say anything more. So I suppose this is everybody has some place that, and I don't mean this in any particularly emotional way, but it's the place that inhabits that part of your mind from which the dreams come. And if you have such a place, your writing is likely to come from there too, ways that you can't ever explain. The Owl. These woods are one of my great lies. I pretend, I have always pretended they were mine. I stumble among the smaller lies as this night falls, and of my presences likewise some, and your voice begins. Who need no hope to hunt here, who love me, I retreat before your question as before my own. Through old branches, who am I hiding? What creature in the bowels quaking that should not be raised against the night, crying its truth at last? No, I who love you, find while I can some light to crawl into. Maybe I will never answer, though your dark lasts as my own does, and your voice in it without hope or need of it, calling what I call, calling me. Me, you, who are never there. Now, I want to jump a long way from that to a poem, a very different kind of poem that was written quite a few years later. Poem, in several voices, called Yesterday. My friend says, I was not a good son, you understand. I say, yes, I understand. He says, I did not go to see my parents very often, you know. And I say, yes, I know. Even when I was living in the same city, he says, maybe I would go there once a month or maybe even less. I say, oh, yes. He says, the last time I went to see my father, I say, the last time I saw my father. He says, the last time I saw my father, he was asking me about my life, how I was making out, and he went into the next room to get something to give me. Oh, I say, feeling again the cold of my father's hand the last time. He says, and my father turned in the doorway and saw me look at my wristwatch, and he said, you know, I would like you to stay and talk with me. Oh, yes, I say. But if you are busy, he said, I don't want you to feel that you have to just because I'm here. I say nothing. He says, my father said, maybe you have important work you are doing, or maybe you should be seeing somebody. I don't want to keep you. I look out the window. My friend is older than I am. He says, and I told my father it was so. And I got up and left him then, you know, though there was nowhere I had to go and nothing I had to do. And then Mark mentioned a book called The Vixen. The form of The Vixen is in some way, all the poems are in the same form in that book, and they're all in some way related to that part of the world. It was a farm village when I found it in the 50s, when I was just over 20, in southwest France, looking down on the river Dordogne. And it was a complete farm village. I mean, I was the first person in that village who was neither a peasant nor French. And it was wonderful to be taken into the village. Now, I'm afraid, I still love it, but it's no longer a farm village, and there are lots of people who are neither peasants nor French, and who, many of whom are there only for a part of the year. But it's an amazing part of the world, and I'm very lucky to have had anything to do with it. I want to read a couple of poems from The Vixen. This is about a woman I was very fond of there. She's about so tall. Called Present. She informed me that she had a tree of Mirabelles. She told me it was the only one anywhere around. She did not want everyone to realize she had it. It might go for years and bear nothing at all, flowering with the other plums, but then nothing. And another year it would be covered with Mirabelles. You know they are not so big as all the others, but they are more delicate for those acquainted with them. She promised me Mirabelles if it was the year for them. She lived in a house so small she must have been able to reach anything from where she was, and her garden was scarcely larger. She grew corn salad in winter after Brussels sprouts. Well, it was a cold garden facing north, so it was slow in spring, better for summer. One of the knotted gray trees leaning against the wall to the south was the Mirabelle. A snow of plum blossoms swept across the valley in the morning sunlight of a day in March and moved up the slope hour by hour. She told me later she thought it would be a year of Mirabelles unless it froze. When she bent in her garden, she disappeared in the rose. It took her a long time to stand up, to turn around, to let herself through the gate, to walk, to do anything. At my age, I have all I need, she said, if I keep warm. Late one day that summer, she appeared at the wall, carrying a brown paper bag wet at the bottom. The Mirabelle, she whispered, but she would not come in. We sat on the wall and opened the bag. Look, she said, how you can see through them. And each of us held up a small golden plum filled with the summer evening. I want to read another poem from that book. This is a different kind of poem. It's a bird poem. There are a lot of birds in the book, before, during, and after. Because although it's all the same place, it's not all the same time. So this one's called Night Singing. Long after Ovid's story of Philomela has gone out of fashion, and after the testimonials of Hafiz and Keats have been smothered in comment and droned dead in schools, and after Eliot has gone home from the Sacred Heart, and Ransom has spat and consigned to human youth what he reduced to fairy numbers, after the name has become slightly embarrassing, and dried skins have yielded their details, and tapes have been slowed and analyzed, and there is nothing at all for me to say, one nightingale is singing nearby in the oaks, where I can see nothing but darkness, and can only listen and ride out on the long notes, invisible beam that wells up and bursts from its unknown star, on, 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 never returning, never the same, never caught, while through the small leaves of May the starlight glitters from its own journeys. Once in the ancestry of this song, my mother visited here. Lightning struck the locomotive in the mountains. It had never happened before, and there were so many things to tell that she had just seen and would never have imagined. Now a field away I hear another voice beginning, and on the slope there is a third, not echoing, but varying. After the lives, after the goodbyes, after the faces and the light, after the recognitions and the touching and tears, those voices go on rising. If I knew I would hear in the last dark that singing, I know how I would listen. And then a third poem from The Vixen is the penultimate poem in the book, and it's addressed to The Vixen. Incidentally, when I told friends that a few of the first friends that they said, the new book, and what are you going to call it? And I said The Vixen, and almost without exception, this was met with great disapproval. And the immediate assumption that it must symbolize some vindictive feeling that I had for former attachment of some kind. And I said, no, the vixen is the vixen. Whatever she may be after you've settled for the fact that she's the vixen, then that's up to you. But the vixen, she's herself first, and she doesn't need anybody to symbolize her. And it's addressed to the vixen, called Vixen. Comet of stillness, princess of what is over. High note held without trembling, without voice, without sound. Aura of complete darkness, keeper of the kept secrets, of the destroyed stories, the escaped dreams, the sentences never caught in words, warden of where the river went, touch of its surface, sibyl of the extinguished, window onto the hidden place and the other time. At the foot of the wall by the road, patient without waiting, in the full moonlight of autumn at the hour when I was born, you no longer go out like a flame at the sight of me. You are still warmer than the moonlight gleaming on you, even now you are unharmed, even now perfect, as you have always been, now when your light paws are running on the breathless night, on the bridge with one end. I remember you. When I have heard you, the soles of my feet have made answer. When I have seen you, I have waked and slipped from the calendars, from the creeds of difference and the contradictions that were my life, and all the crumbling fabrications as long as it lasted, until something that we were had ended. When you are no longer anything, let me catch sight of you again going over the wall. And before the garden is extinct and the woods are figures guttering on a screen, let my words find their own places in the silence after the animals. Then two more poems before I tell you about the Folding Cliffs. These are both from the, well, this is just over a year ago, and the other is from last spring. It's called Waves in August. There is a war in the distance, with the distance growing smaller. The field glasses lying at hand are for keeping it far away. I thought I was getting better about that returning childish wish to be living somewhere else that I knew was impossible. And now I find myself wishing to be here, to be alive here. It is impossible enough to still be the wish of a child. In youth, I hid a boat under the bushes beside the water, knowing I would want it later and come back and would find it there. Someone else took it and left me instead the sound of the water with its whisper of vertigo, terror, reassurance, and old, old sadness. It would seem we knew enough always about parting, but we have to go on learning as long as there is anything. And then the most recent, a poem called Memorandum. Save these words for a while because of something they remind you of. Although you cannot remember what that is, a sense that is part dust and part the light of morning. You were about to say a name, and it is not there. I forget them too. I am learning to pray to Perdita, to whom I said nothing at the time, and now she cannot hear me as far as I know, but the day goes on looking. The names often change more slowly than the meanings. Whole families grow up in them and then are gone into the anonymous sky. Oh, Perdita, does the hope go on after the names are forgotten? And is the pain of the past done when the calling has stopped? And those betrayals so long repeated that they are taken for granted, as the shepherd does with the sheep. Now, let me tell you something about this poem, the Folding Cliffs. I don't expect anyone's heart to leap up at the thought of a 300-page poem, you know, because Not in the 20th century, in the Middle Ages, where they really believed they had all the time in the world until the year 1000. You know, people could read endless things and loved doing it. We reserve that kind of patience for other things usually than poetry now, or they do. I love long poems. I love dipping back into the Fairy Queen and things like that. But anyway, it's 300 pages, and it is a story. I mean, it's not a 300-page poem with no story. And they exist, and I could even name a few, but I won't. And I want to tell you just something about the story. It's based on a true story, but I learned as I knew what was known of the true story for 10 years and brooded on it, wanting to do something with it. Not knowing how, and then started finally digging into find out what I really could find out about it. And in 2 years later, with the help of five other people, really, I knew as much as we are ever going to know about that story historically. And I thought, now if I'm ever going to write, I must try to write. And in the meantime, I'd figured out what the form would be if there was to be one. The basis of the story is this. It happens, the center of it is in the middle of the last quarter of the last century, the 1880s and early 90s. It concerns quite a few people, but at the center, three people. A man, a Hawaiian man, his wife, and their 10-year-old son. He is, they're literate. I mean, they've been to school. They're pure Hawaiian. He is the crack cowboy of the island and also known as the best shot on the island. One of those miraculous shots, you know, who, as they say, never misses. She was known to be very beautiful when she was growing up. And they've known each other since they were children together. This is the time, the 80s was when they began to get worried about the spread. It had been there for 40 years, but they really began to get worried about the spread of leprosy, which attacked mostly Polynesians, attacked Chinese and Polynesians, for reasons that are still not perfectly understood. But they were already looking forward to tourism, which to my mind is looking forward to opening a whorehouse. But of course, they figured that the people whom they called lepers, and by the way, that is an offensive word. If you've never had anything to do with patients of leprosy, you may not know this, but it's not a word. It's a dirty word. It's like you saying nigger. I mean, it's not a word that you ever want to use. They're leprosy victims of leprosy or Hansen's disease patients. It's cumbersome, but at the time they were known as lepers, and lepers were, if anyone was suspected of having leprosy, they were forced to be examined. And if the suspicion was not even certain but probable, they were sent to Kalaupapa, the leprosy settlement, where you never left Kalaupapa. The treatment at the beginning, there was no treatment. I mean, you were thrown off a boat and to swim ashore. And after that, it got a little bit less violent. They took you there in a boat, and conditions got better, and there was the treatment got as good as they could. But they, until the 1930s, they didn't know what to do really with leprosy. And one very great man, whom you, I'm sure, heard about, Father Damien, went and insisted on throwing his lot in with the patients there on the island. Another great man who went there, whom was less well known, was Robert Louis Stevenson. And Stevenson, when somebody libeled Damien after his death, Stevenson wrote one of the great diatribes in English. It's an 11-page letter which just tore this man apart and ended by saying, "The man who did what Damien tried to do is my father." Stevenson, you know, is someone I urge you all to re-examine. He was a heroic, wonderful man and a lovely poet. Anyway, these three people, this family, they were pretty sure the little boy had leprosy. And when an ambitious guy who wanted to be sheriff thought he detected leprosy on the cowboy's face, who wasn't doing what he wanted him to do, he got the cowboy to go and be examined, and it turned out that they diagnosed leprosy. So they gave him the few days usual to get his things together. And the Hawaiian's name for leprosy in Hawaiian for the disease is the separating sickness, because they tore the families apart. And for Hawaiians, this was pain beyond belief. I mean, they'd much rather die of leprosy than be torn apart from their families. And if possible, they would go with the person in the family who had leprosy to take care of them and be with them until they died, and catch, even if they caught leprosy themselves. And this family decided they were not going to be separated. And they joined a small band of fugitive victims of the disease in the remotest valley of the island of Kauai, which is the island on the with the valley on the jacket of the book back there, with 4,000-foot cliffs and impassable surf for over half the year. So a very, very difficult place to get into and out of. And that's the then of course this same sheriff wanted to make his reputation by cleaning out the valley, and he went in after them, and Ko'olau, the cowboy's name, had made it known that they were not going to leave that place alive, and they would take anybody who tried to take them. And so of course the sheriff came in to try to get him, and he tried to trick him and ambush him at night, and Ko'olau killed him. And then they sent soldiers, and Ko'olau killed enough of those so that they gave up. It's a violent story, very violent story. And both the father and the little boy both die, and they bury the child, and then she buries him eventually, and then lives on in that valley alone for months before she goes back. And that's the basic part of the story. So I want to... The poem begins long after the main events, as quite a number of poems do begin in... Didn't Homer say in medias res? You know, I mean, he didn't say it because he didn't speak Latin, but I mean, it was that was the idea. In the middle of things, that's where you begin it. And of course, Virgil did say it somewhere, and that's what Dante was. One of the many reasons that he talked nel mezzo cammino, because he turned it into something else. It was not only in the middle of the story, but in the middle of the life, and in the middle of Dante's own life. The ideal date is in the 35th year, when he'd been misbehaving for 10 years, you know. But according to Beatrice. But it begins quite late in the poem when Pi'ilani, the wife, has heard, not for the first time, that someone is claiming that they have discovered Ko'olau's grave. And she goes back to make sure. And she's gone back a number of times with other people, with friends whom she trusted to get near. She would never go with anybody right to the grave. But this time she goes the whole way back herself. And this means climbing at night up a mountain that goes up to 7,500 feet. And then down the next day, down 4,000-foot cliffs, which are so terrifying that, I mean, the very sight of them will give people vertigo for the rest of their lives to remember them. I mean, they're like, if you can imagine a rainforest Grand Canyon, that's what it looks like. It's like climbing down into the Grand Canyon, only it's green. But it starts with her climbing. Her name means Pi'ilani. Pi'ilani means climbing heaven. Ko'olau's full name was Kalua I Ko'olau, which means the grave to windward. These are night names. These are Hawaiian names that were... Some woman in the family would have dreamed this name and given it to them. And this was a sacred name. This was your name for good. So Ko'olau's grandmother, when she hears about them discovering the grave and moving, she just laughs, because nobody can take the grave from the grave to windward away from the grave to windward. I mean, this is ridiculous. You know? She knows this is impossible. Pi'ilani is climbing the mountain at night, going back. Climbing in the dark, she felt the small stones turn along the spine of the path, whose color kept rising in her mind, burned in color, moment of rust, dried blood color, other color, gone color by day, and she knew what color was there when she could not see it, and when one of the stars was the darkness before any breath of daylight, and the way was in her feet again. The star of Kauea rushed between clouds when the dawn wind came toward her down across the ridges of the mountain, carrying the scent of water from the peak of Waialeale. At a high twist of the trail far down to the left behind her, over the naked roots of the slope and the widening hollow of Waiaka, where the folds of the mountain were still touched by the moon, she saw the sea outside the curve of coast glinting past Waimea, beyond the dark land and the hidden houses. In one of them her father was invisible in sleep. And past there the sea outside Kekaha, where she had been born by the sea of O'omanu, all of it barely a shadow from which she had set out, and nobody had heard her go. Even the dogs in the moonlight never barked when she went past, looked up and watched, and never barked, knowing who she was. And with the next step, that whole horizon was gone behind the mountain. The blackness beginning to the right of her was the chasm of Waimea. The air running from the edge of it rustled the finer leaves of the koas. Above her, the voices of the plovers stitched the night. She's going, as she goes back, she remembers the other times that she's gone up that mountain, of course. It's the way one does these things. And she's going, that leads her back into remembering the lives of the people with whom she's gone up the mountain. This is these sections are all less than a page each, so that one, they read like separate poems. When she had gone up that trail for the first time, they had been together, all of them on horses, Ko'olau, her husband, ahead of her in the dark, and Kua, his friend and elder, riding ahead of him, Kua Papiohule, who had taught Ko'olau from the beginning, always an eye on him, throwing the fishnet, holding the spear, the paddle, taught him the currents on the surface and the ones below, who they were, where they came from, what things they had done, what it was best to expect from them, in what order, as the hours turned in the sky. And Kua taught him the touch with horses, so that even as a boy, Ko'olau was famous for his way with horses. And Kua taught him the braiding of leather, the life of a sinew, the spring of a lariat, and taught him to use the lariat so that it seemed to rise out of his hand by itself and fly wherever he willed it to go and drop there like a tern fishing. Kua taught him the tracks on the ridges and the gun, the handling of the gun. And Ko'olau, they would say, never misses. He never misses. This is Pi'ilani after the night. She comes just as the first light is coming. She comes up to the site of a house at the end of a long rise, very high up the mountain. It's the house of it's the summer house that was built by all of them, of the rancher who was the employer of her husband, a remarkable Norwegian man named Knudsen, who was a botanist, an ornithologist, a musician, a linguist, and who was a man whose own ideas about things evolved in his own lifetime. Very, very intelligent, humane, remarkable man. Dead. So that she's going to meet a woman there, she's going to meet his widow, and these two women who both lost their husbands very recently will meet again at this, for the last time at this point, in the rain and the winter on the mountain. A light rain reached down to her face, the fringe of a mist. There was no color yet in the ghost dawn, but around her through the full consonants of the stream came here and there clear voices opening as she passed close to them, trills telling of water, questions not continued. Some of the voices were lights flying beside her, the amakihi, a yellow brilliance, the olokele, a flicker of scarlet, but the light was the complete gray before daybreak, with the black bands of the trees floating through it. Then, before a condensation of green seeped into the tall reaches of the valley opening ahead of her, the house appeared, Halemanu, at the end of a long rise, with a lifted shell of high trees raised above it, the mountain palm towering behind. And as her feet brushed the wet grass, she saw the four pale long uprights of the veranda, the new wide steps leading up to it, and the dark arms of the house reaching far forward toward her. Someone was there. The smell of wood smoke floated in the mist. And as she stepped forward, a small light passed at a window. She stopped and watched, and a woman came out with no light and stood at the top of the steps. A tall figure in a long gown, the hair built high on her head, the same color as the hour. They both stood listening, and they heard the small stream nearest to the house, the Brook of Tears, Nawaimaka, high with the rains at that time of the year. The tall woman outside the door was looking into the trees and had not seen Pi'ilani. She came down the steps slowly watching the trees, and Pi'ilani walked toward her up the slope and, without raising her voice, said, "Makuahine." And the woman turned, not sure whether she had heard anything. Pi'ilani went closer and said again, "Makuahine." And the woman said, "Who is it?" And then saw her but could not make out who it was. And Pi'ilani pronounced her own name in a voice so low she hardly heard it herself. "Can it be you, Pi'ilani?" And Pi'ilani stepped toward her and for the third time called the white woman mother, "Makuahine." And the woman said, "Pi'ilani," and came to embrace her. But Pi'ilani said, "I will make you wet." And the woman laughed and embraced her and then said, "You are completely soaked. Who is with you?" "Nobody else," Pi'ilani said. And the woman said, come in at once. There is a fire. Are you really up here alone?" And as they turned, the rain began again. As they went up the steps, the white woman called, "Maka'e, Maka'e," calling again at the door. And to Pi'ilani, she said, "Come in, come in," drawing her by the arm toward the fire as a Hawaiian woman appeared in the far doorway. "Maka'e, I know you remember our friend Pi'ilani. We have been out in the rain and are cold and hungry this morning." Maka'e ran to Pi'ilani and embraced her. "How are you?" she asked. "Well, who is with you?" "Nobody." Maka'e shook her head and without a word unwound the sodden shawl and hung it over by the fire. And the other woman picked up a blanket from a chair and put it around Pi'ilani and brought her to sit in the glow of the fire while Maka'e piled on more logs and then was gone. "I did not know you were here," Pi'ilani said. The woman nodded. "We almost never come up here in the winter anymore. It is so long since I was here at this time of year, in the rain, with the streams roaring, hard for the horses to cross. How did you ever cross?" Pi'ilani said, "Yes, the water is high now," and she held out her dripping skirt in front of the fire. "The first time I came," she said, "it was this time of year. It was the same night, and there was nobody here then, and the children were half asleep. We tied the horses out of the rain, and we ate something out there on the steps and rested for a while." "If we had been here," the older women said, "we could have given you something to eat that time." "Maybe," Pi'ilani said, "but that time was different." And the other woman has been asking her questions, and they've been remembering both of their pasts in the terrible rainstorm, which is so deafening they can't hear each other. When it stops, they go on with the conversation. And Anne has asked, the white woman's name is Anne, and she's been asking her these questions. And she finally asked her why she was there, what she was doing. She looked into the fire until Anne was wondering whether she had forgotten where she was, but then at last she said, "They're telling me again, 3 times now, someone has said to me that he has been found, that the grave has been discovered, and they have dug him up and have taken his bones and his gun." "Who told you that?" Anne asked. "Kekaha people," Pi'ilani said. "One of them whispered to my mother but said not to tell me." "Where did they hear it?" Anne asked. "One said he heard it in town from somebody he had not seen there for a long time." "What kind of person?" "He told me it was nobody from here, but they know all about how to sell things like that and who will give money for them." "Did he tell you any names?" Anne asked. "No names," Pi'ilani said. "Nobody's names ever, but they talked about his gun, how his gun had been found. Somebody had dug it up and his bones." "Did you talk about this with anyone else?" "No," Pi'ilani said. "I never said anything, only that nobody knows the place where I left them." She's remembering when she gets, they say goodbye, and Pi'ilani goes on, and she gets up. She keeps remembering, of course, that first trip with when the three of them and their friends and her own mother and cousin have come with them on that time, about 4 years before She's talking about them going up, and she says, all the way going up from here to Kilohana, I think he was talking, she's talking about her husband, Ko'olau, I think he was talking to Kalemanu, the little boy, in front of him on the horse and still asleep. I heard Ko'olau at the turns of the trail telling stories in his night voice floating over the rocks, and he stopped when we rode close to the spring where Nawaimaka comes out of the ground, that low cave that you could pass without seeing it there, and the clear pool that keeps moving into the brook of tears. He told Kalemanu asleep in his arm about the spring, and the child asked, is this where Lahi waits for the soldiers? And Ko'olau said, no, we are not there yet. And we rode on up the trail. Then all at once I heard a raw voice above me, Uwa'u, Uwa'u, like one bird crying, like one seabird, Uwa'u, the petrel. Then I heard Kalemanu laughing, and he said, I know it is no Uwa'u, it is you. Then I heard it again farther up, and again Kalemanu laughing, and he said, I know it is you, Kua, you are not Uwa'u. But the sound came again, and Kalemanu said, it is you, Kua, it is at night the Uwa'u calls. And still Kua and Ko'olau kept making that sound, and Kalemanu laughed, but he said, Lahi will eat you. And he told us he was awake now and kept asking what bird he was hearing, because birds were all around us. He sat up watching them until we came to the high edge at Kilohana, where the trail climbs on, but the whole world falls away in front through the clouds, and the valley of Kalalau appears to be as deep as the sky. Pi'ilani remembered them all saying goodbye then on the mountain, and she looked out the doorway at the morning with its sunlight glittering on the green dripping branches, and she said, Makoahini down there in Kekaha, they tell me now that I never talk to a soul. They tell my mother I never say anything anymore, and it may be true, but see how I have been talking up here. Anne said, I am happy you will tell me these things that must be in your mind all the time now. I have known what happened only as most people do, in parts, and all of them hearsay, and then for a long time I heard nothing whatever, and you had gone back to Kekaha and had been there for a while before I was told of it. Pi'ilani said, at first I would not go out at all. Only the family in the house knew I was there. I was still hiding, but everyone let me alone. Now they do not ask me anything. They move farther away from asking anything. Then she saw that Maka'i had been standing in the doorway behind her listening, and she stood up and Maka'i came over to her. Her voice choked with crying and said to her, I would never have asked you anything that I wanted to know about that time, but when I heard you talking, I could not go away. Do not be angry with me, Pi'ilani. And she put her arms around Pi'ilani and stood with her eyes shut and tears running, and Pi'ilani embraced her and after a moment said to her, it is a little thing. I want to read just a couple more sections. And this is when she finally gets back down into the valley and goes to the grave. And of course, what she remembers is the death of Ko'olau and her burying him. All the details of that. This is when she's climbed down this terrifying cliff alone. And always, of course, it's not just that the cliff is dangerous, it's beaten by the wind all the time, and you never get down there. You're climbing through the clouds, and you always get caught by the rain, too, the wind and the rain, so it's very cold climbing down. Nobody, incidentally, has climbed down there and lived for the last 70 years. Somebody tried it not about then and didn't make it because there's a skeleton hanging in a bush way down. But anyway, she knew the way down. And she had been sure before she set out that nobody had found where he was buried, and she had been sure of it all the way up the mountain through the night. And she had kept seeing the grave as she went, the fur of moss around the black branches above it in the deep shade, back among broken rocks, with the cliff looming far overhead and the stream leaping across the stones below it. And it appeared to her to be untouched, the ferns and bushes grown over it, unbroken, undisturbed, unnoticed. How could it be taken away from him when it was what he had always been? It was where the cold touch had come from that ran down between her breasts at their wedding when Reverend Roll carefully pronounced Ko'olau's whole name. "Do you," he had said, "Kalua I Ko'olau, do you, the grave at Ko'olau, do you, the grave on the windward side, take this woman, Pi'ilani, climbing heaven, to be your lawful wedded wife from this day forth?" And the rest that he had sworn to, and that she had sworn to, with that cold still running on her. Only once near the end she had asked him about his name, and he had told her what she had already known about it, how Kawaluna, his grandmother Kawaluna, the age above, had been there when he was born, and she herself had delivered him, and when she held him up she had announced, "He is Kalua I Ko'olau." And if anyone dared to ask her later, she always answered the same way, saying that she had known it in the night. And it was in the night that he had died, just as the ia, the fish, the Milky Way was turning, and Pi'ilani, after his breath had stopped, when his pulse was no longer there, had put her head down on his chest with her hair across his body and had listened to the darkness below her and the darkness above her, while the last embers of the small fire among the rocks at their feet went out, and the cold of his hands deepened, and her tears kept turning cold when they ran down onto him. She heard the darkness of the mountain under her all the way to the underside of the sea floor, and through her hair she heard the night winds high in the valley rising and leaving, and she heard Uwa'u, Uwa'u, the cry of the petrels echoing in the cliffs, the stream whispering over the rocks, and the faint sound some said were crickets, and others said were land snails singing, and they were spirits. And when the wind was quiet, she could hear the sea far below her, where all the waves ended. She sat up in the dark and saw where the stars had come. She picked up a shell and started to pat it, rocking slowly forward and back, chanting under her breath. First she chanted to him by name, by the name that she had called him all her life, and already she could hear the difference. "Ko'olau, Ko'olau, you are going now, you are still here, you are going, you are not sick anymore, you are not dying now, but if you want to come back, Ko'olau, come back, come back." She had chanted the same words until she heard them go out like the fire, and she patted the shell, rocking without words, and then began again, "Ko'olau, it is the time of your going. I hear the sound of it, but I go on trying to think of something to give you where you are on the mountain that keeps turning away, and all that is left here now is that you are gone." She chanted until the stars at the top of the cliff began to grow faint in the ghost dawn, and she stood up then and slowly climbed down to the stream and washed her face and hands. When they had been sure that he would not live many more days, they had moved for the last time together back to the hollow where they had taken Kalemanu when the child was dying and where they had buried him in the low cave at the foot of the cliff. And when it began to be day, she pushed farther back in the narrow among the rocks and found a place deep among them, not far from Kalemanu's grave. And there she knelt, chanting her husband's full name, "Kalua I Ko'olau, Kalua I Ko'olau." And as she chanted, she began to pull back the ferns and pry up the stones. But she had only the stones and sticks and the kitchen knife to dig with, and she dug all day, but at sundown it was not deep enough, and she slept that night beside him, and all the next day she dug the grave, knowing nothing but what she was doing, until late in the day she thought it must be deep enough, and she lined it with ferns and hauled Ko'olau's body to it and settled his gun on his chest, and then filled the grave and rolled stones onto it and closed the bushes back over it. Thank you.